Travel presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine with your host, me, James Patrick Regan, otherwise known as Jimmy from the Deadlies. And today I'm speaking with singer and guitarist Michael Sweet, most recognizable from his band Striper, but also is in the band Boston and Sweet and Lynch, among other projects. In our conversation, Michael tells us why a solo album. It's his 11th solo album and tour plans behind the album. Michael discusses his home in Massachusetts and his time as the worship leader at his home church. Michael takes us through his youth in Southern California and his original band, Rock's Regime, that played a lot with hair bands whose names we all know, and the transformation to Striper. Michael takes us through his gear through the years and his obsession with tone and how the yellow and black color scheme came about, and the guitars he's currently playing, Sully Electrics and Godin Acoustics. Michael talks about his guitar heroes early on, and he talks about his home studio, as well as the studio where his band tracks and mixes. And he talks about his production work for his band. Michael takes us through his work with George Lynch and the band Boston and the possibilities of working with them again. Michael talks about the future of Striper and the logistics of getting the band together with all the members living across the country. And he talks about tour plans for Striper. To find out more about Michael, you can go to his website, michaelsweet.com. That's michaelsweet.com. Please subscribe, like, comment, share, and most of all, review this podcast. I'd really appreciate it. And please support Vintage Guitar Magazine and all the wonderful things they do for us guitar players, because they do so many wonderful things for us guitar players. Here's my friend Michael.
Hello.
Hey there, Michael. How are you?
Good.
It's just an honor to speak with you. I appreciate your time.
Nice to speak with you too, man. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me, and I'm honored. So.
Oh, don't be. I'm honored. I realize you're very prolific, but why a solo album?
Well, I mean, this is, I think, if I'm correct, this is going to be my 11th solo album release.
Okay.
And, you know, I've been doing solo albums since 94.
Wow.
I wanted to release solo albums back in the 80s, and it's not an ego thing at all for me. What it is, I'm ADD, ADHD, OCD, and my mind is just constantly racing, and I have songs in my head 24/7.
Sure.
And to do it only with one project, one group,
yeah,
I'd be limiting myself, and I think I'd go crazy actually if I couldn't express those musical thoughts, you know. So that's where I'm at, and that's why I keep releasing solo albums.
Right on. And are you planning on touring behind it, or?
Well, you know, that's always the question. It's difficult because Striper is so busy.
Sure.
We're always doing something. I try to go out and do solo touring and put something together, but it just never seems to pan out. But I would say for this album, it's possible that it could work out. And it should work out because it's a completely different genre, different market, if you will. And, you know, hopefully I'll be able to do something.
Yeah. Kind of aside from that, do you play at your home church? Like, are you a regular at your home church?
You know, I used to be. There was, when I moved back here in 95, we became part of a home church. And I wound up being the worship leader.
Oh, right on.
Yeah. I wound up leading the music every Sunday. And I did that for a while, for a few years. And then I got busy again in music and started traveling, and I wasn't able to do that. They hired a real worship leader. And, you know, I haven't really gotten back into that on a regular basis in terms of playing for churches. I do on occasion play, but not every Sunday.
Sure. And when you're doing that, are you playing an acoustic guitar, or are you bringing in your electric, your whole rig?
Usually an acoustic, but sometimes in an electric. But usually it's an acoustic. And, you know, I love acoustic guitar is a different animal.
Sure.
And I love it. This is my opinion. It doesn't really matter, but I'll say it. You know, there's a lot of guys that play electric guitar and then they get on an acoustic and, you know, you wonder if it's the same guy.
Sure.
And then vice versa.
Yep.
I've always played acoustic ever since I was a little kid, and I kind of kept at it. And it's a different dynamic and a completely different animal. But I love playing both electric and acoustic.
Sure. And So you said when you came back here and you started playing in your home church, where's here? Where are you based out of now?
Well, I moved back to Massachusetts in 1995.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Are you originally from Massachusetts?
I am not. I'm originally from California.
What the hell are you doing in Massachusetts?
I know. Well, you know, it is a question a lot of people ask. Basically, we wanted to get out of California.
Okay.
For a number of reasons, and not to disrespect anyone that still lives there. Yeah. But it just wasn't for me anymore. I was born and raised there.
Yeah.
And I'm a California boy through and through. But, you know, when I go back to California now, it just doesn't feel like home.
Okay.
And when I come back to Massachusetts, it feels like home.
Okay. Fair enough. What was California like? So you grew up in Southern California, I assume?
I sure did. I was born in Whittier, and then we lived in Fullerton, lived in La Mirada.
Okay.
Pasadena for a brief period, but I'm a Southern California boy, and you know, I was going to the beach every weekend, catching the bus to go down there and boogie board and surf. I always had a tan when I was younger, and you know, I'm that guy, and I loved California. I loved growing up there.
Yeah.
And at the time, especially back in the 70s and 80s, it was incredible. But, you know, it's just so different now, and it's not really my thing. And I come back to Massachusetts, and I love it here, and it's just a different lifestyle.
Sure. So you mentioned, you know, growing up there. Like, in the 70s, what was Southern California like? Was there an opportunity for you to see live music when you were, you know, in your teenage years?
Oh yeah, man! I went down to the Strip every weekend.
Did you really?
I started going down there when I was 15 years old.
Oh my God! So pre-hair band.
We were a house band at Gazzari's.
Oh, Rock's Regime or Striper?
That's when we were called Rock's Regime.
Yeah.
And we were a house band. We played every weekend. We played with Mickey Rat, who became Rat.
There
was another. Another group called LA Boulevard. We played with them a lot. We would play and then walk down the street at the Troubadour and see Wasp and then go back and play and then walk down the street to the Whiskey and see Motley Crue. And sure. It was kind of a crazy time, to be honest.
So pre all those bands, did you see Van Halen or Quiet Riot when they were, you know, when Quiet Riot had Randy and all that?
Saw Van Halen after their club days. Never saw them in their club days, and okay. They were a Gazzari's band as well.
Uh-huh.
And we just missed them by a few years.
Yeah.
But I'm a huge Van Halen fan, and when I say huge, I mean, you know, I would list them in my top three rock bands of all time.
Sure.
But I used to see bands like, I don't know if you remember a band called Smile.
I do remember a band called Smile. Yes.
Yep. I used to see Smile a lot. I saw Quiet Riot way back in the day, and Dubrow,
yeah.
And they became Dubrow.
Yeah, yeah.
A band that Tim was in called Stormer.
Sure, I remember Stormer.
Yep. There's just so many bands. Steeler. You saw and played with Steeler and when Yngwie was in the band briefly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, a lot of cool history, you know.
And Betsy Weiss and her band, Bitch.
Oh, of course. We played with Bitch, and we played with Witch.
Oh, right
too.
On.
Band called Witch. So, yeah, it was Max Havoc, a band called Max Havoc, another band called VBSI. They were great. There's so many great bands. Great White.
Yeah, of course.
You played with them on occasion back in the day. Yeah. So, you know, I look back at that on those times and those years and I think, wow, what a blessing it was to be alive and in the middle of that time frame. Incredible.
Sure. Yeah. And how seedy was the Strip at that point?
It wasn't seedy. I mean, at least I didn't see it that way.
Uh-huh.
Maybe it was as seedy as you can get, but I didn't see it that way. I just saw it as an exciting scene, and I was in it, and I was thriving as a young musician, absorbing it, taking it all in, learning, and that's where I lived. I would literally get, when I didn't have a car, I would get a ride down to the Strip and get dropped off and then figure out a way to get home. and I always did. I always figured out a way. I got a ride from somebody. I met met another, a couple guys that were into music, or a couple pretty girls or what have you. And I always figured out a ride home, and it worked out.
Were you playing guitar in bands in high school and singing in high school?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I always played guitar. I played guitar first.
Okay.
And my dad started teaching me my basic chords when I was 5.
Wow.
And I got my first guitar when I was 5. And I always loved guitar. I was always fascinated with guitar and guitar tone. And then I became the singer for my brother's band when I was 12, almost 13. And I didn't play guitar in his band. I kind of set the guitar down for a little while. Then I picked it up and started playing guitar again, and we became a trio.
Okay.
Which I'm sure quite a few people don't even know. I always look at myself as a guitar player first and a singer second. But unfortunately it didn't really work out that way. I'm kind of known as a singer first and sometimes not even known as a guitar player. So I'm always reminding people that, hey, I play it as well. So,
And those early years, what were you playing?
Way back in the day, my first electric guitar was a guitar that my grandmother gave me, and it was an Epiphone, solid body, early 60s. I want to say a 63, a maroon color with a white pickguard.
Wow.
And it had single coils, and I love that guitar. It had a great neck on it.
Was it like a Cornet or a Wilshire or one of those?
I'd have to look it up. It had the single cut. It was a single cut.
Okay.
And I know John Lennon had this same guitar for a brief period of time.
Huh.
And I wish I could get that back because I love that guitar. But that was my first guitar. And then I got into buying gear, and I bought Les Paul.
Uh-huh.
And then I bought a Hamer. I had a Hamer for a while.
Wow.
I had a Dean, and then I went back to Gibsons. I bought Stephen Piercy's white Flying V.
Wow.
And that's the one that you see that's striped when we were a trio.
Okay.
There's some photos floating around. My brother taped it and varnished it and kind of ruined the guitar, you know? I went through a lot of guitars. I was probably more of a Les Paul guy for about 2 or 3 years. And then I eventually became a V guy, and I've played Vs ever since for the most part.
Okay. All right. And what about amps? What were you using for amps back then?
Back in the day, I was one of those guys. I would go in a music store when I was a kid, when I say a kid, 15, 16 years old.
Yep.
And I would pick up a guitar, plug into an amp, and it would sound like crap because it was just, I was plugging straight into it. And I always wanted to improve the tone. So I would go back in the PA department, pro audio department. And I'd say, hey, see that EQ there? Let me try that into the front of the head. And they'd say, you can't do that. That's for PA.
Uh-huh.
And I'd say, of course I can do it. Let me try it.
Yeah.
And it was a Furman PQ3.
Oh, wow.
And it was at a music store called Whittier Music.
Okay.
And I plugged that in to a Marshall, and the rest is history, as they say. That was the striper tone. I added that 800 and got that real squawky Michael Schenker tone, that was the striper tone, man. And it kind of blew everybody's mind in the music store. Everybody was like, what are you doing? And eventually, guys like Dimebag heard it and wound up using a PQ3 and 4.
Oh, wow.
And a number of other people. So I'd like to think that I kind of started that trend, but who knows?
Right on. That's great. Did you end up using Marshalls in those early days?
I used Marshalls in the early days, but there was something that I bought. I would go, basically, I was always on a quest for tone, and I still am, but I've mellowed in my old age. But back then, I would literally, I couldn't contain myself. I would go out to pawn shops and music stores almost daily.
Uh-huh.
And in search of the ultimate piece of gear to give me my tone. So I went down to LA. I went to a music store down there, and I wound up to a pawn shop. I wound up finding a Lab Series.
Yeah.
You remember those heads, right?
The L11.
Yeah, L11. They made an L5.
Yeah.
But the L11 was the higher wattage head. And basically what I did is I took that head like an idiot, and I wound up not having a speaker come out of it. So the head really should have blown.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a hybrid head. It had a few tubes, but it basically solid state. And I preamped out into a Marshall.
Uh-huh.
And that Lab Series had a little semi-parametric on it.
Yep, it did.
And I would boost that 800, and that would be the tone. And we would play with Rat, and they would come up to me and say, "Man, what are you using?" And I would hide that behind my Marshalls.
Uh-huh.
And I'd say, "Hey, man, it's just a modded Marshall." And they'd be like, okay. And, you know, that was the sound. And then it went from the Lab Series to the Furman PQ3.
Okay. All right. Speaking of Rat, I mean, Rat was famously using a lot of Charvels and Jacksons. And I recall you being one of the first users of Jacksons.
Yep. Rat would come in to Gazzari's with all their Charvels and Jacksons. And I would think, wow, you know, they've got some killer guitars. I was using at that time a Les Paul and an Explorer.
Okay.
And I eventually became a Jackson guy.
Uh-huh.
And that would be, I bought my first Jackson in 84.
Uh-huh.
It was white, Rhodes, and Robert taped it. And it became that infamous model that I used early on. And then I signed a deal with, it never signed a deal with Jackson, but I became an artist.
Uh-huh.
And I exclusively use Jackson's from 85 on.
Okay. What are you using now?
Right now I use Sully.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Guitars.
I just saw them at NAMM.
Yeah. And I love Sully's because, to me, this is my opinion again, they're the closest thing to an old Jackson.
Yeah.
They really are. When you pick those up, you feel like you're playing an old Jackson. And they're quality, and I love them. And I love John Sullivan. He's a great guy.
Yeah.
And I'm a Sully artist.
Right on. Right on. How about amps right now?
Right now for amps, when we travel and we do a rented backline, I use Marshall DSLs.
Okay.
2000s. I love the headroom on those. Yep. They're consistent and they're punchy. But in the studio, I'm using EVH heads.
Okay.
And we just tracked an album and I used exclusively an EVH 5150 EL34 80 watt.
Wow.
And that thing rips, man. It sounds so good. It. So great.
Yeah. Early on, you mentioned Michael Schenker. I assume Michael is one of your guys that you listen to. Who else? And besides Eddie Van Halen, of course. But were there other guys you were listening to? Were you listening to Gary Moore or anybody like that?
Well, early on, when I started really absorbing all the players that I heard, it was definitely Michael Schenker.
Uh-huh.
And I never really thought that he rubbed off on me back in the day, but I can kind of hear it now in little notes here and little licks there, and in my vibrato to some degree, and even my tone. My tone, I've always loved that half-cocked wah sound.
Yep.
And he had that.
Yeah.
Mick Ronson had that.
Sure, yep.
Even to some degree, Ronnie Montrose had that.
Yep.
And I've always loved that. So definitely Michael Schenker. And then once Randy and Eddie came along, Eddie first and then Randy to my ears, they were huge influences as well. And I've always loved John Sykes as well. He's a huge influence. And, you know, guys like Gary Moore, of course.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I've never really learned Gary Moore licks and set and tried to take that in, but I certainly have with Schenker and Eddie and Randy for sure.
Uh-huh. In your travels, when you're looking for gear and stuff, did you ever run across Chris Romano at Black Market Music?
You know what? I remember the name Chris Romano, and I know we've met.
Yeah.
But I'm not that familiar with Black Market Music, to be honest with you. Yeah, but I tell you what, if I could have, I certainly would have.
Yeah, yeah.
I would have been there in a heartbeat. I mean, anything gear related,
uh-huh.
I'm the guy that's like, oh man, I got to go check it out, and I'm obsessed with gear. I'm a tweaker and a knob turner, and I drive everyone around me crazy.
And now, living in Mass, is there a music store or music stores that you go to regularly?
There is. There's a music store called the Pedal Shop.
Okay.
And it also has a secondary name called the Music Box.
Okay.
And that is in downtown Plymouth. And basically, they offer every pedal you can imagine.
Uh-huh.
On Earth, boutique pedals, really sure. Cool stuff.
Yeah.
They've got some vintage gear that goes through the store, but he also owns a store called Music Unlimited in Kingston, Mass. And they're more of a retail shop, and they sell Marshall, Fender, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And what's your pedal collection look like?
Oh my gosh, man. I've got a lot of pedals, probably nowhere near as many as, a few other guys. But if I had to guess how many pedals I have, I would say well over, well over 100.
Wow.
Easily. And I kind of use them all. I'm one of those guys, like when I'm going to the studio, I'll take 10 or 15 pedals, and the next time around, I'll take 10 or 15 different pedals. I'm always trying different delays, different choruses, and looking for that sweet spot and, something that just sounds better.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of always my thinking, like, let's make it better. And do I achieve that? Yeah, probably not, but, I try. And this last time in the studio, 2 albums ago, I used the EVH 50-watt EL34 and the 6L6 head Stealth.
Uh-huh.
And this time around, I used the EVH 80-watt.
Okay.
and it just had a little bit more oomph to it, and I loved it. But, I use Mesa Boogie, Mark. I've got a couple Mark IVs.
Uh-huh.
I love Marshall. I mean, there's nothing like a great Marshall head,
yeah.
And I'm always drawn to that Marshall tone.
Sure. Do you have any?
I love boutique heads too. I love boutique heads like, some of the, like the Rev heads and, there's a lot of great stuff out there.
Oh, man. Yeah, for sure. Do you have any sort of collection of vintage Marshalls?
I don't have a collection of vintage Marshall, to be honest with you.
Uh-huh.
I really don't. If I was basically set free to go do whatever I want to do and just be a hermit in Mexico somewhere, living on the beach in a trailer, I'd probably have lots of vintage gear, and that's probably all I would spend my money on. But reality doesn't permit, you know?
No. And do you have a home studio?
I do. It's not really a studio. It's a man cave that I have that looks more like a Starbucks down there. And I've got some soundproofing put up in a little corner I go and sing in. And I sing into an SM7 Shure mic.
Okay.
And I use an Avalon Apollo.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of the company that makes the Apollo. And I can't think of the company, and you know who they are, an old vintage company that makes new gear now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, that's what I use. So it's all digital. It's all in the digital realm. And I've got an Avalon plugin and a Distressor plugin, and that's what I sing through, and I love it. But I wouldn't ever record drums or loud guitars here.
Okay. But you are recording your vocals there?
Oh, yeah. I track all my vocals here and sometimes guitar solos.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's great. That's great. And where do you guys track the rest of it?
We go to a studio called Spirit House.
They're in Mass, and they've or somewhere got, else?
That's out in Longmeadow, Massachusetts, and they've got all the gear, man, like vintage gear coming out of their ears, modern gear. It's beautiful studio, and that's where we go and track all the basics.
Uh-huh.
And then I come home, and I track vocals and solos here, and then I go back, and we mix there.
Sure. That's great. I remember early on, we were listening to Steely Dan to check our stereos and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But I also remember that we were listening to Hell with the Devil. I mean, that album sounded so great, and that was our test if it was a good stereo or not.
Well, you know what? Well, you know what's interesting about that album, Love Us or Hate Us, that was a very cutting edge album, way ahead of its time.
Absolutely,
and especially sonically. And the reason why I say that is we tracked at a place called Master Control, and they were the first studio. This is what I was told. Uh-huh. They were the first studio to have a Mitsubishi 32-track digital machine.
Okay.
So we tracked that album in the digital realm, and man, that album is as clean and punchy as it gets. It really is. Yeah. And we did some crazy stuff. Like we – instead of two tracks of rhythms, we did four tracks of rhythms. Everything was times two, you know?
Yeah.
And it paid off. It was just a wall of guitars. And the drum tones, the kick drum, everything about that album is just Punch City. And I listen to that album and it sounds great today.
Yeah, yeah. And was that self-produced or do you guys have a producer?
We had a producer. His name was Stefan Gelfast. And he got the gig based on having produced, or so we thought, having produced the John Waite single, Missing You.
Oh, of course, yes.
But we found out after the fact that that wasn't entirely true, or the way it was presented to us. But putting that aside, we co-produced that album. So, we were producers as well. And especially, not to pat myself on the shoulder, but especially me, I'm that guy that's always there. If the session's 12 noon to midnight, I'm there at 11 and out by 1 a.m. I'm there through it all. Whether it's drums, bass, guitars, vocals, you name it, I'm very involved and very hands-on.
Yeah. And are you for your solo album, did you use a producer? Or for your, and just in general, are you producing everything now?
I am all the Striper albums I'm producing.
Right on.
The solo album, the new solo album, it's a completely different animal.
And
unlike any Striper album, really. And it's co-produced. So, yes, I produced it along with a gentleman by the name of Jeff Savage, who is a keyboard songwriter out of Nashville.
Okay. Right on. Right on. That's great.
Oh, yeah, man. And it's cool. I can't wait for people to hear the album because it's very different, very eclectic. And
yeah. No, I heard the track that you released, but I
Master Plan.
Yes, exactly. It's fantastic. Sonically, it's just as clear as you'd expect from you.
Well, man, look, to me, my take on that is there's so many albums that come out from artists from my time period that it shouldn't come out. I just kind of I hear and not every album but quite a few. Occasionally you'll hear an album that sounds really great. But there are so many albums that just sound like over compressed and almost distorted and not well recorded and not really thought out properly. And again, my opinion, and I just kind of shake my head and I think, gosh, why would you guys allow that to go out? And I try really hard not to release anything that isn't up to par.
Sure.
I really do. Now, do I succeed at that? Probably not. But I try.
Yeah. How'd you guys come up with the Yellow and Black Attack?
Well, Yellow and Black Attack, you mean the first album? Or you
I mean
just
the yellow, just the color scheme that you guys
okay.
were using.
Well, I'll tell you what. If you interview me and then you interview my brother, you're probably going to get two versions of that.
Okay.
And I love my brother. I love my brother to death. But I recall when we were Rock's Regime, one day his drum walking in the garage and he's painting his drums yellow and black.
Okay.
And they looked an awful lot like Edward Van Halen's Bumblebee guitar.
Sure, sure, sure.
And this happened after that first album came out, Van Halen.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say that that had a lot of influence on our Yellow and Black.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And then eventually it just continued to grow, and one thing got striped and another and another, and then the cables and then our clothes and then the walls and everything.
Yep.
And it got to a point where if you walked in our garage back in 1983, you would definitely possibly get a headache, or if you were prone to strokes, you might have a stroke, you know, because it was a lot going on, man. And it was kind of crazy.
Yeah.
But you know, that's part of who we are. And you know, the visual side is just as important, obviously, as the musical side.
Yeah. Yep. 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 How'd you get hooked up with George Lynch for Sweet and Lynch?
Well, you know, Serafino at Frontiers reached out to me.
Okay.
And said he wanted to do a project that sounded like Dawkins with John Levin,
uh-huh,
and myself. And as much as I love John Levin, I think he's a brilliant guitar player, I said to Serafino in an email, I said, well, why don't you just go for the guy who was in Dawkins?
Sure.
And, you know, let's really go all the way. And he said, well, do you know him? I said, yes, I do. And uh-huh. I'll reach out to him. And I did. And the rest is history. I mean, George said, sure, I'm in. And you know, we've recorded, I want to say, 3 albums together.
Wow.
And we may do another album. Who knows? I really don't know. I've gone on record to say that the only way I would do a 4th album is if we do it like the first album.
Okay.
And that was with Brian Tichy and James Lomenzo.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. And those guys are badass. You're not gonna get a better rhythm team or department than those two, and that's the only way I would do it. And in order to make that happen, it costs money, and yeah, you know, the budget would need to increase most likely. So yeah, there you go.
When did you get hooked up with Frontiers as a label?
Oh my gosh, that was back in, I want to say, I think 2010.
Okay,
they had licensed an album and released it.
Okay.
And that was when we were signed to Big Three.
Okay.
And we liked what they did. And then once we were out of the deal with Big Three, Frontiers was interested, and we were able to negotiate a good deal. And we've been with them since 2010. And I couldn't even tell you how many albums they've released. I want to say, oh, man, probably 10-ish.
Yeah.
And then you got to figure the 3 Sweet and Lynch albums, the yeah, 2 Iconic albums, yeah, and the 2 Sunbaum albums, and the Soul Driver album, and now a solo album. It's just, it goes on and on and on. A lot of albums.
Yeah, exactly. And are they, I assume they're good to work with because you've been making so much music for them.
They're great to work with. And I'll tell you, they are the only label I've ever worked with that allows us to do what we do and not hold our hands,
uh-huh,
and not try to tell us what to do.
Sure.
And who really believes in what we do and appreciates what we do and respects what we do. And, you know, that goes a long way.
Yeah.
And you know, history shows that, obviously we're both happy. Both sides are happy because we're still working.
Yeah, exactly.
So, it's a lot of music, and yeah, here we are in 2026, and I could see us working together until I retire.
Yeah. Are any plans on retiring?
Well, no plans right now. But I got to be honest with you. When I think about retirement, it sure sounds nice. you know, just chilling at home and growing a beard and, yeah, you know, putting on 20 pounds sounds amazing.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think you're going to do that. Not anytime soon. How'd you end up in Boston?
Well, I'm not 100% sure.
Okay.
I give my version and I think that's correct, but I don't know with certainty. I wrote something about Brad Delp when he passed.
Okay.
And what he meant to me.
Uh-huh.
And it went online, and Kim Scholes read it, Tom's wife.
Yep.
And she reached out to my manager, Dave Rose, and wanted me to come sing at what was going to be their last show.
Okay.
And I said, sure. And they wanted me to sing a song called Higher Power. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, I had never even heard that song. And I'm a big Boston fan. Yeah. That was the first album I ever bought.
Sure.
So I went and listened to Higher Power, and then I got it. I realized why they wanted me to sing that. Lyrically, it was tailored more towards my faith and whatnot.
Yeah.
So I said, sure, absolutely. And then I was mowing the lawn one day, and Tom called me, and he basically opened the door for me to come and sing more because some of the singers had dropped out.
Oh, wow.
Mickey Thomas and Sammy Hagar and Ann Wilson, they weren't able to show up.
Okay.
So I wound up singing More Than a Feeling and Peace of Mind, Rock and Roll Band.
Yeah.
And playing guitar. Yeah.
Did you play the intro to More Than a Feeling?
You know, I don't even remember.
Okay.
I don't even remember. You have to watch the videos on there's video on YouTube.
But, okay.
I remember being in rehearsals. I walked in and we started with guitars, and Tom was really impressed and loved how the guitar sounded and said they've never sounded so good.
Cool.
And then he said, all right, you know, a few days later at rehearsals, he said, all right, let's hear you sing More Than a Feeling. And I had to go in the bathroom and splash water on my face and change my underwear because, you know, to me, in my opinion, that's the hardest song in rock and roll to sing, period.
Yeah.
So I just did my thing and they liked it, and thank God. And then they asked me to join the band after that show that was supposed to be their last. Yeah.
Did you tour with them?
I did. I toured. They asked me to join in 07. And they said, we're going to put together a tour for 08. I thought it was going to be, you know, 10, 15, 20 shows. It was 56 shows.
Wow.
And with Styx opening. And we went out and we headlined arenas and sheds, and it was mind blowing, man. And it was more, I viewed it as a celebration to Brad.
Sure, sure.
And, you know, that helped me get through it because I was going through a tough period. My wife was sick at the time and I was her caretaker. So it was just an awkward, odd feeling to be out on the road during that time.
Sure. Is that why you left?
Why I left the band? Well, I would say not really why I left the band. No, because Kyle passed in 09.
Okay.
And I left in 2011.
Okay.
And I basically, just for a number of reasons, primarily because I felt like they were going to continue touring, which they did. And that would have meant that I would not have been able to tour or do anything with Stryper.
Sure, sure, sure.
So you would have seen a lot less from Stryper. And I think like the priority is and should be Stryper.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I left, you know, and I remember getting a phone call, you know, from the publicist of Boston, and you know, they weren't too happy with how I did that, because I just kind of did a press release and did it and moved forward with leaving it. And I think they wanted to do it a different way, but you know, I don't have any regrets.
Sure.
Because I was able to focus on Stryper and make that a priority. But you know, if they do anything more down the road, Boston, I mean, who knows that. I don't even know if that door is open. For me, I know they bring back people on occasion that were once in the band, and who knows if that would ever happen with me. I have no idea. But I can say this. I respect Tom immensely, and I love Boston, and they shaped me a lot as a musician.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Did you have a hand in at all with who followed you?
No, I our old bass player, Tracy Ferry, wound up joining the band after I left.
Okay.
And but in terms of who took my place, I'm not even, I can't even remember. I don't even know his name.
Okay.
But, it, you know, someone that became a dear friend of mine is Tommy DiCarlo, the other singer.
Sure, sure.
And he's a great guy, man, and a great singer. And what a story that was, because he was basically working at Home Depot, and then he's on stage singing Boston.
Yeah, yeah.
which was just mind-blowing and really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. This might be naive on my part, but is being in Boston, does that have a hand in you why you live in Massachusetts now?
Well, it could indirectly or directly. I don't know. It might. I mean, it certainly made life a lot easier for me because I was able to drive to rehearsals.
Sure.
And drive to what was going to be their last show and go to Tom's house and watch American Idol.
So you'd already lived in Massachusetts at that point.
I was living at that point. I moved in here in 95, and took place in 07 through 11. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Oh, yeah. I know. Crazy. So, I mean, it certainly made it easier for me to be in the band.
Yeah.
But I would think that even if I lived in L.A., you know, I would have just hopped on a jet and, you know.
Sure.
Yeah.
Is everybody currently in Stripe, or is everybody in Massachusetts?
No, nobody is. Yeah. No, I'm the only one. And, now that my wife, who co-manages the band, obviously lives here. Uh-huh. My daughter, who works for the band, lives here.
Okay.
And the label, Frontier's my label liaison and A&R guy, uh-huh. He lives up in New Hampshire.
Okay.
So he's literally an hour and a half or two away from me.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool.
It is. Where does everybody else live?
Well, you know, everyone else is in different states, man. Unfortunately, Rob and Oz are in Vegas.
Okay.
And Perry is in Myrtle Beach.
Okay.
Our co-manager, Dave Rose, is down in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Yeah.
We're kind of all over the place. Our crew guys are, a couple of them are in Maryland, and one guy lives in Texas.
Okay.
And we're kind of all over the map, you know?
Yep. And for rehearsals, where do you guys hook up?
You know, believe it or not, when we rehearsed, we were going to Nashville.
That makes sense.
And we had all of our gear at a place called Soundcheck.
Yep, of course.
And we moved our gear just a few weeks ago from Soundcheck to Massachusetts.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And we'll probably be rehearsing here. It could be in my little studio downstairs.
Uh-huh.
We do like little, powered speakers and electronic drum kit thing.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And we just rehearse and then we go out and do the real deal with backline. Or if we're on a big tour, we'll be pulling a trailer with our own gear.
Yeah. Do you ever spend time in the town of Boston, the city of Boston?
You know, I do, but not often. I would say a couple times a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I love it. Whenever I go to Boston, I absolutely love it. Actually, you know what? I spend more time than a couple times a year because I go to so many doctor's appointments there. So it's actually more like four or five times a year.
Okay.
Between my eye and my thyroid issue. So, yeah. I do actually go to Boston more than I thought.
What's your eye issue?
I had a detached retina twice.
Oh, yeah.
So I go up there to get checked out.
Yeah.
They keep a close eye, no pun intended, on my eye.
Yeah.
And then I go and get my thyroid checked as well. I have another appointment in June.
Okay.
I'll be going back. So, yeah.
When you were a kid, you know, GIT had probably just started. When you were a kid, and it was probably specifically a jazz school. Do you ever give any thought when you were a kid to go into GIT or Northridge or any of the music schools like Berklee in Boston?
You know, I have, and I've had people ask me, and literally people that work there ask me. And I've always felt a little, I'll be honest, a little intimidated. To do that, and mainly because I'm not a theory guy.
Yeah, but still.
It would be more of a thing where I just go in and I tell people what I do and show them what I do and the history of what I've been through and how I accomplished this and that tone-wise and whatnot.
Yeah.
But I'm not a theory guy. I can't sit there and, you know, tell you every note I'm playing and what scale I'm playing. But I don't read music. I can chord chart very, very well, actually.
Good.
But, that's always been a little bit of an intimidating factor for me. But it's something I would love to do. And maybe someday before I leave this earth, I'll have a chance to do it.
Right on, right on. Apart from your solo work, how many dates is Stryper doing this, you know, in a year, say this year?
Oh man, I tell you what, last year we didn't do a lot. I want to say maybe 30-ish, maybe a little more. This year, I don't think that many at all. I mean, wow. so far we've only got like 3 or 4 on the books. But we tend to do that. Like, we're not a band that goes out every year and oversaturates the market.
Sure.
So many bands do that.
Yeah.
And they're out there, you know, every year playing the same venues. And then I start to notice in their videos that there's, you know, 100 people in the crowd.
Yeah. Yep.
And 5 years ago, they had 1,000 people in the crowd.
For sure.
And I just think because they're oversaturating and people don't necessarily want to see bands like us every year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, I'm sure some people will argue with me on that and say that's just not true. But I mean, you know, the videos don't lie.
Oh, no, it's true. It's definitely true.
The ticket sales don't lie. You can definitely oversaturate. You know, if you're a huge artist, like, you know, pick one. Yeah. And you're out there playing stadiums, that might be a different story. But for bands like us, I just think you got to be careful. So we try to alternate touring with recording or other projects.
Okay.
And that's why I do side projects and solo projects and whatnot to just keep it moving.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Makes sense. Do you do like Monsters of Rock cruise or any of the cruises?
Oh gosh! Oh yeah, we're doing Monsters coming up.
Okay.
We're gonna be on the cruise this year, and then we're also going to Italy. We're doing a Frontiers Festival.
Oh, right on.
And we've got a few other things going on. We've got a new record we're finishing up. Oh. I'm gonna be singing for the next month and recording solos.
Okay.
And that'll get mixed in March, and it'll be released this year.
Right on.
So I would say in terms of touring, next year will probably be a lot busier.
Uh-huh. Cool. What's your guitar collection look like at home?
Oh gosh. I always joke with my wife about that. I say not that much, not that big of a collection. Then she says, really? And we go open up the curtain. I've got, you know, a decent amount of guitars, but I'm nowhere near the collector of like a Dave Amato or anybody like that.
Oh. Well, let's hope not.
You know, Dave's got like a warehouse full of vintage guitars.
Stuff he's never touched.
Oh my gosh. I've got, if I had to guess right now, definitely probably about 50-ish guitars.
Okay. And is it like Gibson? Is there anything vintage in there, or is it Gibson and Jackson and Sully heavy?
Yeah, not a lot of like old vintage 50s, 60s, or even 70s guitars. I've got a few.
Uh-huh.
But I've got a few Jackson guitars, absolutely old originals.
Uh-huh.
I've got some nice Gibsons, some Les Pauls. I've got some PRS guitars that I played with Boston that I love.
Of course.
And, you know, just lots of odd and end Stryper guitars over the years.
Uh-huh.
Some acoustic guitars, but nothing that would make you go, oh my gosh, you know, that's worth how much? $100,000? Uh-huh. Nothing like that. But just guitars that I like, that I use, that appeal to me, that sound great, that play great, and I enjoy owning and playing.
Yeah. Is there an acoustic guitar that you prefer to use?
You know, back in the day, I used to use Guilds.
Oh, right on.
And I loved them.
Yeah, of course.
I'm a Gibson guy too, but I always liked the way the Guilds sounded, and that's what I used on all the old Stryper albums.
Okay.
Nowadays, you know, I'm an artist with a company called Godin.
Oh, of course.
And I love their stuff. They just came out with a new acoustic guitar that I think is amazing for the money, bang for the buck.
Uh-huh. What model is that?
What's that? I'm trying to think of the model number. It's a brand new guitar.
Okay.
And it's like a large body standard acoustic versus their typical Acousticaster or something
like
that.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. Great guitar. And then I was also an artist with Washburn, and they made me a few signature models.
Okay.
that are really cool, man. Custom one-off acoustics that I love.
Sure, sure. So outside of all this music and everything and performing and recording, what do you do for fun? What are you doing?
Oh, man, not a lot. Not a lot. I mean, to be honest with you, a day in the life of Michael Sweet would be staying in your jammies and, you know, working on music in your jammies and then basically, you know, taking a walk, getting some fresh air, yeah. Maybe running some errands in the car.
What's the temperature outside right now?
Oh, God. Right today, I think it's 30. We were a few days ago. We were like single digits.
Yeah.
And we've got about 2 feet of snow outside.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a different world here. But I love it. I love the, you know, the different seasons. And I like snow. And I like when it melts and it gets warm and the flowers bloom. And I love it. I love the fact that it's not hot all the time or not cold all the time.
Yeah. Are you a coffee drinker?
I am, unfortunately. And I think my kidney stones don't appreciate that. You know, I mean, I drink coffee and I pass a few kidney stones and my doctor just says, stop drinking coffee, drink more water. It's like, I do like coffee. Yes.
Yeah. Right on. And is there any particular type of coffee you like but more than any other cup kind of coffee?
You know, I'm into this Nespresso thing like everybody else.
Oh, sure. And
I buy the Starbucks pods, but I keep telling Lise we should just go back to the French press.
Yeah.
That's the best coffee you can have. And we have one and I don't know why we don't. You know, I like getting in the car and getting out of the house and making a run to a local coffee shop.
Sure. Sure. Right on. Well, Michael, it's been an honor to speak with you. I really appreciate your time. This has been great for me.
Oh, man, dude, look at it. Thank you. Great job. And I hope you're enjoying some warm weather.
Yeah. Well, I'm in California. I'm in San Francisco, outside of San Francisco.
Okay. So you get a little chilly there, too, from time to time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it's 30. In the morning, it's 30.
Yeah.
So
then it warms up to a nice warm sunny 32.
Well, thank you, sir.
Hey, brother, you have a great one. Stay out of trouble. And,
likewise.
And come see us when we're in town, okay?
You know I will.
All right, bro.
All right. Thank you.
See you, my friend. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to Have Guitar Will Travel. You can catch up on all the things I'm doing at thedeadlies.com. And I'm on all the social media platforms as well. And please support Vintage Guitar and all the wonderful things they do, because they do many, many wonderful things for us guitar players. Thanks. Please subscribe. Please tell a friend. And I'll see you guys next week. Bye, guys. We'll be right back.